Welcome to the Athenaeum Review podcast. I'm Ben Lima, and I'm very pleased today to be joined by David Carrier, a philosopher and art critic with many wonderful publications, including, I will mention, a number of pieces for Athenaeum Review. He's in the forthcoming issue, reviewed the Duchamp retrospective at MoMA. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
I thought I could just start by asking you to orient perhaps those who have not seen the show or read your piece or even know a lot about Duchamp to kind of introduce this topic.
That's good. Thank you. Right now, Museum of Modern Art in New York has Duchamp's show, and they talk about the fact that this has been 50-some years. The previous one was in the 1970s. And so the natural question is, you know, what can you do with someone? I mean, we haven't discovered a lot of new works. What can you do after 50 years? Well, you have a younger audience, a newer audience. That's part of the story. But it's also, and I think this is the interesting part, it's also that some new things have come up. Now, maybe we should give a brief, as you suggest, Ben, a brief introduction here, the background. Okay, Marcel Duchamp, 1887 to 1976, was a French figure who comes to New York at the turn of the 20th century and has a kind of reputation then. But then he's basically hangs around in New York. And finally, in the 1960s, his moment arrives. And in a sense, you see, it's a kind of interesting delayed reaction in that suddenly American art is ready for him. I mean, we have Jasper Johns, we have a Robert Rauschenberg, and we have just everyone else. And suddenly all those people are there. And there's a wonderful bit of dating that's interesting. In the 1960s, the young Andy Warhol has his first gallery show in LA. And who is having a first museum show at the same time, but Marcel Duchamp. And so they actually meet. And so Duchamp is old at that point, but I mean, it is the kind of interesting delayed reaction of Duchamp catching. Now, what's so important? Well, in the early 20th century, when Duchamp shows in New York, he does the Cubist works, and those are interesting. But in honesty, if Duchamp had died in 1921, I'd be a minor Cubist figure, but he wouldn't compare with Braque or Picasso or any other number of figures. But there are the ready-mades. The first of those in 1917, urinal men's bathroom fixture that is presented as a work of art. Now, those are around, and again, look at the date. These are around the time of World War I. They don't have any big impact. I mean, people talk about those, they discuss them. And then Duchamp lives in New York. And it's an interesting kind of exhibit existence that's been much written about. That's when New York was cheap. That's when he had the $5 lunch. And he had studios, and he lived there. And Duchamp was very determined that he would have a low-key life. He didn't want to be very commercial, though he was. It's come out bit by bit. He wasn't a minor art dealer. So it's not completely pure. So there he goes. So this is, we're talking about from World War I on. Now by the time of the 60s, suddenly this becomes Duchamp's moment. And now there's all this fuss about him. And fortunately he has good health. And so he's around. And now people are really starting to look at him seriously. So that first MoMA show is in the 70s. And that's the kind of apotheosis of Duchamp. Now, and I remember that when I actually saw that show, it shows how I'm aged too. And, you know, there was a kind of catalog essay that said, can anything more be said about Duchamp? Because it's an endless subject. The people just thought they had more and more and more and more and more things to say.
Yeah.
And so obviously the question is now in 2026, what new is there to say about him? In other words, what can he add? And I'll give a kind of interesting historical perspective. When I was in New York the last trip, there were two shows that I reviewed. I reviewed for you, the Duchamp, and I reviewed for another journal, the Raphael. Well, Raphael, there's more and more to say. The problem there is that everything is immovable. It's all in Rome, basically. Duchamp, you say, well, we've talked about him, we've had... Duchamp has become an academic subject. So what is there new to say? Because with some artists, and the way I would put it in my essay for you, Ben, is that, you know, let's take Matisse. You want to see a Matisse show. Well, the Matisses are great because you contemplate those and you look at those. But the Duchampian world, you see, with the ready-mades, with these objects like the urinal, the bottle rack, and the other things that are pushed into the art world, you want to say, but look, yeah, it's not, I mean, I've seen it. I don't feel that I really need to sort of contemplate it. I mean, it would be kind of weird to say, I want to look at that bottle rack a little closer. I want to look at this, because you say, well, these, it's conceptual art. You took an ordinary object, you put it in the art world, and that's interesting, but I've kind of seen it. I mean, it's not like the aesthetics of art racks are, or urinals or the other objects are really so interesting.
Yeah.
So the immediate question that I'm sure came up at MoMA was to say, well, why another Duchamp show?
Yeah.
And that's, see, what I want to talk about here on this blog. That, I mean, there's part of a thing, of course, that the art world, we got to say, look, we have a new audience. It's been 50 years. We want the younger people, younger than me, to see the show. Okay, that's fine.
Sure. Yeah.
But it's also that, what is there new to say?
Yeah.
And I went to the show and in Manhattan, and the objects are really familiar. And I mean, you know, you say, yes, there's the bottle rack, there's the urinal, there's the bunch of other objects and some of the other objects in the paintings, which in my view are interesting, but sort of minor. But I've seen all that stuff. So it isn't like I was so enthralled by that.
Yeah.
And I mean, I can even remember for you, Ben, I thought, oh, I don't know. You know, maybe this is just one of those revivals. What am I going to write? Because you want something new. And I went through the catalog, and the essay is at the end, not the front. And that's part of the game, because it's three younger curators at MoMA. And the title of the essay is Duchamp and the Museum. And I thought, museum, why? You see, we did. Now, let me back up a little and talk about what the basic issue always was that I had 50 years ago.
Yeah.
What is a ready-made? A ready-made is something that comes from out of the art world and is put in the art world. So you have a men's urinal, you put it in the art world, you turn it 90 degrees, okay, you sign it, he signs it Armut, there it is. Or you have a bottle rack, or you have other sorts of objects. But I mean, basically, these are the kinds of things you put in the show. So hence, it's ready-made. I mean, and the title is that it's already been made and the artist didn't make it. He chose it or selected it or put it in the... And Duchamp liked to goof around, you know, with all this erotic play, ready-made, AID, you know, here.
Yeah.
And it's a male urinal. So, I mean, you can see how the 50 years of discussion of Fountain, I mean, could go on about, you know, yeah, okay, you got this male fixture, and here it's turned 90 degrees, and da-da-da-da-da-da. And of course, the question is, why is it a work of art? So this is what sustained people, and in my field in philosophy, people could say, well, we really want to talk about this. And there were various theories which we can sort of very quickly figure out here. One view is that the urinal is a beautiful porcelain object. It's a kind of sculpture, and it looks not unlike a lot of sculpture. So there it is. Even if Duchamp didn't make it, he chose it and selected it. It's like a sculpture.
Yeah.
Well, you could do that. And then you could do all the psychological things that I've played with. You could say, well, but it's got a certain kind of joke, and it ties into Duchamp's big interest in eroticism and in his later works, and, you know, a lot of erotic play. Okay, you can do that. And then you can, of course, you could talk about consumer culture. Here we're manufacturing all these objects, and why is it that we can pick one of them out that looks like all the others, and we can put it in a museum, we can say it's a work of art. So these kinds of ideas, I mean, you can see how, in a sense, these discussion, it's no wonder the discussion could go on and on. Yeah. Because the three little notes I've just mentioned, I mean, you know, you could write a book about this, and people have many books about this.
Yeah.
And, okay, that's kind of interesting. And then you can talk about the fact that initially, you know, were people going to select these objects? Some people wanted to turn them down. And there's an elaborate history of people saying, man, that's not a work of art. That's just a functional fixture that you find of plumbing.
Yeah.
That the bottle rack, the other kinds of objects. Well, why would we care about those? And the fact that Duchamp has an aura, kind of aura of an artist. He did other things, more elaborate works that clearly are works of art, paintings and installations. You say, well, okay, that's all interesting, but this looks like really small potatoes.
Yeah.
Very small potatoes. Now, so the question is, what's new? And why, you see, and my puzzle in going to MoMA and buying the catalog and then sitting in the cafe, you know, on the fifth floor and thinking, okay, I'm going to work on this and have a drink before I go back and look at the show. Why the fuss? Why are we showing this now again? Why Duchamp in the museum? Now, the story I want to tell, Ben, has two parts here. The first part is purely the biographical, autobiographical stuff, biographical stuff of Duchamp, which is in the catalog. And the second part is the conceptual. And the first part is fully laid out in the catalog. And the second part is what we have to piece together. Now, Duchamp has been written about a lot. Of course, like everyone, he was a New York personality. He hung around forever. He finally married. He wanted to marry when he was older, and he married the former wife of Matisse, the art dealer who was the son of Henri Matisse.
Right.
So it's a very French story of this marriage. You know, they got married, and there he is. He's sitting in New York, and he becomes a kind of celebrity. And then after his death, this is really marvelous, 1976, he said, I've been doing nothing. Well, it turned out that opposite his living studio was another studio in which he had a work that was kind of, how can I describe it? You can see it in Philadelphia. It can't travel. It's a kind of people, you look through this and you see a picture. It's the eroticism of the female figure with her legs spread. Holding a lamp.
Yeah.
So you can imagine the amount of bookish scholarship, I mean, iconography, because she's holding this, she looks like the Statue of Liberty, she's holding a lamp, da-da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
Turns out that at the MoMA show, there was a new book, and there's a picture that Duchamp's last girlfriend posed for this. And so now we have even more information. Well, this is all great. You say, but, you know, this is art history, drowns in information, and people can't leave it alone. And isn't it wonderful, you see, that Duchamp kept his mouth shut so that after he died and he said, well, I'm not really doing anything, they found that there was this whole big work that people didn't know about. That now it's all in the Philadelphia Museum, and you can go there. And it can't move to MoMA, but it's kind of weird, at least if you're a male of a certain age, because you kind of kneel down in the gallery and you see a people. When you look through the people and you see this sculpture of the woman with her legs spread looking out towards you. Okay, I got it. Now, people think this is seedy. People think this is great. I don't know. You see, you could play with this, but I mean, there it is. I mean, and at a certain point, the kind of mystique is, I can remember be told that you couldn't take a photograph. Well, this is, of course, nonsense, because you have your camera, you take a photo. I mean, but what do you see? I mean, you know, if you're into pornography, okay. But I mean, it's not, there it is. I mean, and now we know the story that the woman was a kind of prominent social figure. And there's a whole book about her life and her affair with Duchamp. So you can learn more about that. Well, That's the personal stuff. Now, where does this go? Because you see, I think you can see at this point in history, if you went to the MoMA director 5 years ago and you described what I just did, he said, well, you know, I mean, okay, Mr. Carrier, but I don't really see a show there. I mean, yeah. Peep shows are, you know, in our culture, we've had it with this.
Yeah.
Why Duchamp and the museum? What in the world is going on? Now, it's at this point, and this is such a tease, as I wrote in my review for you, Ben, that you have to read the catalog at the last part, the last 6 or 8 pages. The rest of it, you know, a $60 book is just, it's all the catalog raisonne, but it's stuff that everyone has known for 50 years. But the end, what does the end tell? Well, Duchamp in his older age, and remember he lives into the 60s, was very concerned with his legacy.
Yeah.
And he and his patrons who had paid for the works toyed with a lot of museums, with Philadelphia, with MoMA. They considered places in California. They really wanted to have the gathering of his works in a museum.
Yeah.
And this would be a request. And this, you can imagine, was, and oh, we have all this detail, was a complicated business because, of course, it involved money and promises of the future. And if you know anything about museums, I have a modest friendship with Philippe de Montebello, that he said to me once, he said, look, eternal means 50 years.
So yeah. Say,
sure, Marcel, this will be up forever. But what we mean by forever is, you know, because who knows, if you're not fashionable, then poof, you go to storage. You're in the museum. I mean, but you're out in the whatever they put the storage. So Duchamp and his patrons, they had to fuss and fuss. And finally, they put it in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Now, so this is the biographical point. Now, you can say, well, it's strange because Duchamp hated the museum. He said he had famous things. He hadn't been to the Louvre for decades when he was there. And, you know, I mean, in a sense, his whole art was a critique of the museum. So why in the world, you see, would he have put so much fuss into his legacy?
Yeah.
This looks like, in a straightforward way, a contradiction. I don't like the museum. Oh, but I'm really concerned. The body of my work is shown in the museum. I want a good home for it. Da, da, da. Not just for the ready-mades, but, you see, for all of the other paraphernalia that you can see at this moment show.
Yeah.
So the question is, what's going on there? Now, it's at this point, you have to read the last 8 pages of the catalog. And I'm afraid, you see, if you want to figure this out, you have to splurge on the catalog because the rest of it is all familiar, but the last 8 pages is dynamite. And here's the story as I construct for the review for you, Ben. You see why it's so interesting. Well, for a philosopher, and I'm a philosopher by training, the basic thing about the ready-mades, let's go back to them, was always about why are these things works of art? In other words, why is plumbing fixture a work of art? Let's take that case. The others are similar kind of issues. And you can have the kind of claims that I've made just now. You can say, well, it's got aesthetic qualities, or it was picked by the artist, or and a lot of ink has been spilled, you know, those are arguments at great, great, great length. Okay, well, that's fine. That's been done. That doesn't seem to have, you see, much to do with the museum because that involves merely to asking about this object. And here's the kind of example I would pick, Ben, to understand, you see, the force of this. Suppose that tomorrow you were inspired by my talk and you went to MoMA. You got a plumbing fixture and you showed up and said, I'd like to appoint with the curator. And I have a urinal here I got from the plumbing store. And I'd like to put it in your collection. Now, the MoMA would throw you out. They would say, I'm sorry, you don't understand. The Duchamp is a work of art.
Yeah.
What you have is just something from the plumbing fixture. And though they look identical, they're visibly identical. They are really, really different. Okay. That's the basic scenario. It doesn't seem to have anything to do with museums. But here, and you see why MoMA is so smart, here is what the catalog presents that's the twist. This is the very end of this catalog essay. Toward the end of his life, a number of things happened. There were a bunch started to be in the 50s and 60s Duchamp shows. And in particular, there was an Italian impresario, Arturo Schwartz, a very strange guy, who wrote about him. So they needed ready-mades. I mean, you need a complete Duchamp show. You need everything he picked. Now, in some cases, the originals had been lost. Okay, so Duchamp found another. Now, let's take it a step further. In some cases, you see, there was a demand for the objects, and Duchamp allowed his curator friends, like Arturo Schwartz, to identify more of them. In other words, they say, well, all right, we got a fountain here, but we want to have another show. Here's another museum that has a show. Okay, here's a fountain, another one for them. And the catalog explains that in some cases this was done with elaborate, you see, I mean, in some cases the things had been lost.
Yeah.
Racks or whatever. These were early 20th century objects. And so in some cases they had to take those things and say, well, here's what the photo looks like. And this is a photo from 1917. So we're gonna fix it up. We're gonna make it as best we can. And a lot of work went into recreating these. Now, so Arturo Schwartz presented a bunch of these objects, and he sold them, and he had multiples. Now, you see how we get into the museum, because it becomes a strange story. Well, let's suppose I can understand that the original fountain, it was found by Duchamp, and there it is. But now you're telling me that 50 years later, someone else can find a similar thing or make a similar thing and put that into the museum and have multiples. And I would say, well, we got half a dozen here. And you can read it again in the catalog that it was like any kind of multiples, like people do other multiples. They say, all right, we're going to have six of these. And one belongs to Duchamp, one belongs to Schwartz, one belongs to someone else. And you say, well, it looks to me like we got an awful lot of these things. And how do we understand this decision? That is, let's press this. Arturo Schwartz could show up and put a ready-made into the museum because he had Duchamp's authorization.
Yeah.
Duchamp would show up at some of these shows and sign the stuff. Is he signing the new stuff? The new copies of the old ready-mades. And say, okay, those are kosher, those are okay, but you or I can't do that because otherwise, you see, there would be too many ready-mades. I mean, if every urinal, if every bottle rack in the whole art world, in the whole world was a legitimate one, then
yeah,
that's tough. So this is, you see, the clever point in the catalog where you say, well, okay, damn it, how does this museum work? What is the institution that allows multiples? Now, here I offer a thought experiment, you see, to see how fiendishly clever this whole business was. Last night I was getting up, and I couldn't stop about this whole business.
Yeah.
Okay, let's take another case. You're at the Met, and you'd like to have a Piero della Francesca. Well, they don't have one. But you say to one of those Italians, you know, who makes nice copies, you say, I love a copy of the Piero. How about the one in Venice? Make a really good one.
Yeah.
Put it in the Met. And you say, no, I'm sorry. That's no good. That's a copy. You just can't. You just, you know, that's just another, it's a painted copy of, you know, Piero. A genuine Piero has to have the provenance coming from Piero. This is the basis of the art museum. This is how it goes. Okay. But what's going on with these ready-mades? Well, Duchamp gave the authorization. He said you could make more. But he gave the authorization to other people to make more. And you say, well, you mean he could, Duchamp could say to this Italian figure, Arturo Schwartz, well, you can make a bunch of these, and so then we'll have more ready-mades. And yeah, what we're saying here is, well, this is how the institution of the museum works, that the authority kind of gets pushed along the line to Schwartz, you see, and to other people. Now, this is, you see, where what the catalog is delivering on its promise. Because here's the way I would put the issue. I mean, you know, in a simpler way, maybe than the museum, than the catalog, the MoMA catalog does. What we have to understand is no one questioned this, right? There was no one who showed up at the MoMA show and said, this is a fake.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some of these ready-mades were never touched by Duchamp. Never. They're made. Someone looked at a photo of the Duchamp and said, we're going to make something that looks like that. And you say, okay. But that's like my Pierrot replica. That looks right. like a Pierrot. And you say, no. It's you can't make a copy of a Pierrot, but you can make a copy of a ready-made. 50 years later, it looks right. What does this say about the museum? Now, this is where at the end of the catalog, you see, so brilliant in my view, you see, they really ask this question, well, what's going on? What did Duchamp, you see, and again, I stress that the point was that people believe this, people question this. And here's the way I would put it, I mean, in a different way than the museum, but speaking as a philosopher, that we understand in life that there are all kinds of implicit rules. A very simple one, in America, drive on the right, in England, drive on the left. I mean, we all know these rules to the point that they don't have to be spelled out. We just all follow them. And if someone asks the rules, then we have to have a reconstruction. That's what we do in philosophy. Well, we are willing to accept that the ready-mades, including not just the ones that Duchamp picked, but these other objects, are works of art, though, you see, the thing that you or I show up at MoMA tomorrow with are not works of art. Well, there's a kind of implicit rule, and you need those rules because this is how a museum works. In other words, a museum has to assume that there is a way of putting things that are in the walls and things that are outside of the walls. And what's in the walls at the Duchamp show and what's outside is not. Well, but what in this case is that rule? Well, because I know something, but I know something about Duchamp, but I can't anoint a ready-made. Well, why can't I do it? You know something, but you can't do it. But Arthur Schwartz could do it, and everyone accepted the show. No one had any question. So it's at this point that, you see, that Duchamp's ambivalence comes together. And what I would say, just very briefly to wind this up here, you see, we have to see that Duchamp, we're aware that he was very critical of the museum. He put in a banal object, a functional object, and how could this be in the museum? This looks like you're destroying the museum. But at the same time, you see, he's preserving and keeping that museum, that institution go by having this object, but playing with all these games that make the object fit into the museum. So we really have to see Duchamp's basic ambivalence. It is, if you will, philosophical. On one hand, you offer a critique. On the other hand, you offer a supporting account, you see, of the institution. You do both at the same time. That's the brilliance. And what I would say about this show is that show, you see, shows the essential ambivalence of Duchamp. It shows that the issue of these objects is not just, are they works of art, but it's how do they intersect with the museum and the institutions. And that's why I think it's a brilliant show. Sure.
My follow-up question might just be, speaking as someone who's been in a classroom teaching about modern arts, and students who live decades after Duchamp and perhaps take some of Duchamp's perspective for granted and maybe don't see what was once so novel and radical about it. Yeah. I wonder what you say to perhaps a young person who comes and says, oh, okay. Great, you know, what makes perhaps a member of the younger generation excited about this?
Sure. I think that's a very interesting question. You see, on one hand, and a little bit of this is in my review for you, on one hand, it seems like Duchamp's moment has passed, because what are we finding, and I've written about this now for a decade, well, there's an interest in women. There's an interest in non-white artists, non-white males. There's an interest in looking out the United States. And I mean, and the great transformation of the art world that I've puzzled over a lot is looking for Black artists, looking for Asian artists, looking, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you see this, it's very interesting. You see this not only in New York and America, but also in Europe. It's a global change in the art world. And okay, we have the white artists. Males, this is great, they're fine, but we want to look at other things. So from that point of view, you say, well, Duchamp, he's just, you know, he had his moment, but there it is. So that to have a Duchamp show is a bit like having a Matisse show or another Picasso show. And you say, no, we don't want that because we really, and for reasons I support completely, we politically want to look at women, we want to look at Latinos, we want to, et cetera. We want to look at all these other things outside of that traditional world. When I thought about this and did one of these little collections of my work, and I looked, and I was shocked to discover that, because I started writing criticism 50 years ago, is that, you know, to a certain point, everything was white male. But this was out there. It wasn't like I was making some choices. It was what the big shows were.
Yeah.
Why Duchamp? Well, we need to find something different. And I think the idea that is in, again, the title of this essay by MoMA, Duchamp and the museum, the idea that he's hooked into the museum in a way I'm trying to play with here, that's the new point. That's why there's something, that's the justification of the show.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that makes it, actually, this may relate to another sort of one aspect, which I have not seen the show myself, but I read your review and I looked. Apparently, there are many, many of these, the boxes, the bois d'envolées. I wonder what you make of that and how that works.
Well, but this is that is something, those have been around, of course, all the time. At a certain point, Duchamp, what a sense of humor he had, he made a little sort of portable museum version of his own career, a little kind of carrying case. He made, I don't know, 30 of them or something, that you could carry around with little models of replicas of everything. And, you know, this seemed like a kind of cute trick. This was kind of his commercial side. But of course, this is tied now into all of his interest in how the museum functions. So in the catalog now, though, that gets gathered in into the more general ideas that all is concerned of the museums. That's familiar. I think the idea that he fussed so much about his legacy, that was sort of in the literature, but it wasn't quite so prominent as I see in the catalog. That's really come to the foreground. Now, of course, you see what's going on, and maybe I need to emphasize this, is an interest in the museum as an institution. And compared to 50 years ago, that issue has been foregrounded. There are all the critiques of the museum. And again, I've written a lot of that. You know, that's around all the journals. It's in your journal and it's elsewhere. The museum, I mean, you can see how this goes politically. The museum is this temple of the privileged. On the other hand, it aims to appeal to the broad culture. It aims to appeal to everyone. It wants to welcome every gender, ethnic group, and so forth and so on. But at the same time, that's a great problem. And that, I mean, I've written about, everyone's written about. I mean, that's just such an issue because if you think about it, what is a traditional museum? Well, it's a temple. Think of, you know, the older buildings, let's say the Met in New York or the Met, you know, I mean, go to every one of the museums. Well, it's this grand, well-guarded place is for the privileged. And politically, that's now in our culture, museums want to be friendly. They want to be accessible.
Yeah.
And there's even the simplest thing that you can think about just traveling is the difference between going up the temple steps, as in the Met in New York, and being on the ground level, as in MoMA in New York, in the newer building, where it's meant to be accessible. It's meant to be, here you are immediately, like a department store or like a store on the ground floor. So all of that is that, you see, that's, and all this discussion of museums and all the battles. I mean, when I've written about this, look, I mean, a museum, why are there all these conflicts? Well, because you couldn't design a better home for conflict than an art museum. I mean, this. The director is well paid, millions of dollars. Some of the curators are paid okay. Most of the staff are paid very poorly. One of the journals had that in Pittsburgh here, and people that were, you know, 40, 50 years old were getting less than the minimum wage, who had been working there for decades.
Yeah.
And of course, the collector class, well, they have to be rich. So the contradiction of the museum, if you will, is that it brings together the rich collectors, and you need them because the art's expensive, with the director, and then with, you see, people who are really rather poorly paid. Yeah. Well, so the museum, the institution, I mean, it's just, you see, people talk about this, but it's just inescapable. You're not going to get around this. you're not going to get around this connection, this conflict, and the fact that you see that gentrification has gone up and up and up and up, and that the surely the curator's wages, let alone the staff wages, have not kept up with inflation. Well, that's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the fact that museums charge more and more to get in. What is MoMA now? $30?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so it's like the. Now, I'll give you a story. A few years ago, I was interested in writing about an artist. You can figure out who she is, who had was given a commission that was argued about at Goldman Sachs in Manhattan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I wrote a column about this. And I thought, well, I can go there. I mean, it's on the. Down by Wall Street.
Yeah.
Of course, what I found when I went there, and I should have realized, their guards were perfectly friendly. They're not, this is bulletproof glass. They're not going to let, you know, art critics into the lobby because, you know, this is just asking for trouble. Well, so Goldman Sachs, you need to have a Goldman Sachs ID. And I think it's fair to assume that the Goldman Sachs employees are not.
Yeah.
Concerned with, Julie Moretti, are not concerned. They probably don't look at the art a lot. This was a trophy and it was a good commission and you could argue about it. That's okay. So that space is really controlled. MoMA is not. MoMA cannot shut down. So there it is. And this means that the art museums are really the soft underbelly of the social system in which, again, they're just such obvious places for conflicts about money. I mean, you can't escape it.
Yeah.
And this isn't to be critical of anyone or cynical. It's just to say, but I mean, the director of MoMA gets paid a lot.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, compared to hedge fund guys, nothing.
Yeah. Right. Well, I guess just as maybe a kind of final question, thinking about, you know, certainly when I was started to study art, you know, 25 or 30 years ago, it seemed very clear that Duchamp was recognized as one of, if not the sort of founding figure of contemporary art, you know, and certainly influence on Johns and Warhol, as you discussed, it was sort of like this world of contemporary art goes back to Duchamp in some way. And so, but, you know, now zooming ahead to 2026, I wonder your views on that. Do you think that's still as clear as maybe it was then, or is he such a clear founding figure of this art world, or what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that goes back, Ben, to what I was saying about the end of that Eurocentric view.
Right, right.
That now, I interviewed a few years ago this marvelous man who's dead now, Kean Weiser, you know, he was an African who worked in America and, you know, had all those world histories. And when we talked in the interview, this is on Radio, you can find it. I asked him what he thought about this story. When Michael Fried, the great Fried, still around, was young, he had a show called Three Americans at Harvard in the 1960s. He was
right.
And he pronounced that, you know, he was a graduate student. You know, this is good. He pronounced that Jules Zelitsky was the greatest living artist.
Yeah.
Now, Aki and I, we just laughed about this because, you see, this is someone in Cambridge, Mass., and this is sort of, you know, pride goes before the fall.
Right, right.
But, Michael, have you looked at Africa recently? China, have you been? You've been looking around at those Asian, and I mean, you see, this was the grand, and of course, this is tied to American politics. The immediate news from the day as we read it, you know, and all the Trump and all such, obviously this is tied to this change of the art world. So where that's going to fall in 50 more years for Duchamp, I don't know. But I don't think that New York centered art world, white male New York, is going to be the thing of the future. And what I found when I started to think about this a lot 10 years ago was that a lot of the black artists, just taking Americans, okay? These men and women, they were there. It wasn't like those are all kids who suddenly were 18.
Yeah.
They were some of them have died. You know, I had, when I started out as a writer, there was a guy, Sam Gillian, who came to Pittsburgh. I hadn't written anything, and he was working, had a kind of position at the Carnegie Tech, you know, because Carnegie Museum, Carnegie School, you know, a kind of job you had when you needed a sort of one day a week job. Well, then he had an apotheosis, and now he's died. So all that world has just changed in an inconceivable way. And yeah. I don't know how that's going to fall out. And I mean, your question of how is it going to affect the world of Duchamp, that I don't know. But I'm sure that the history is going to be completely different. And I mean, I've read so much and written so much. There's a book, I can't even do all these names right here, a book I reviewed that only had women artists,
yeah,
modernists. There's a book that looks, there's a lot of literature that looks on Black artists, that looks on Africa, that looks on world art history. Yeah. I'm sure that all those things are going to look very, very, very different.
Yeah, and, yeah.
I think I mentioned I'm doing this crazy review where I wanted to see the three shows, the Whitney, the Carnegie, and the Venice Biennale. This is only this is a crazy yeah. idea because I've seen two of them and my memory is, you know, is fading. But if you look at those shows, I mean, suddenly you see the world has opened up. And it is interesting that you see in New York and Pittsburgh and also in Italy, that you have this idea that it has to somehow be world. And yeah. that's where, but to answer your question, you see, Ben, where does Duchamp fit? I don't know. Certainly he's a potent figure, but where, I think we're at a moment that it's really impossible. It's as difficult as trying to figure out the political economy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And you say, well, when I was young, the United States was so powerful, and we're not. You know, I'm going off to Europe, and I'll tell you a minor story. Because I'm interested in the history of travel books. And I have this little book. You remember Europe on $5 a day? Well, you're too young.
Oh, but I know what you're talking about, yeah.
This was it. And when people like me in the 60s graduated from college, we got a Eurail pass and we went to Europe at $5 a day. And it wasn't crazy. I mean, you know, maybe it was 6 or 7 or 8, but I mean, you could go. I mean, you could go to Paris and London and Rome and so forth. And the book has been reprinted. Now it costs $27. But the original book has been, well, you see how in that sense, the era of American hegemony is just gone. And that's, you see, I want to tie it into the Duchamp. Where things will look, I don't know.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, art historians who are young, I pose this as an exercise for your students. What does art history, what does it look like? You see, once you look at this biennales I mentioned now, where you have all the Africans, all the Asians, all the Latino and so forth, and not just Duchamp. I mean, Duchamp is there, but what does it look like? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm curious. I don't think we'll be around to see it, but if in another 50 years, I wonder what MoMA will do or won't do about Duchamp. But well, we've been speaking today with David Carrier about the Marcel Duchamp exhibition at MoMA in New York, and his review is forthcoming in Athenaeum Review.
No, it's traveling, so go see it.
It's traveling to Philadelphia.
Yeah, yeah.
Thanks very much for being here and having this conversation.
Thanks, Ben. It was great fun. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Good. Bye. Good. Me too. It was. There's more of the podcast and other materials at athenaeumreview.org.
Thank you.